Thank you, Matt. I want us to open our Bibles together to the book of 2 Timothy chapter 4. It's going to be really helpful to you if you have a Bible open in front of you. We're going to move verse by verse through this paragraph in a message that I'm calling How to Finish Well. This past week, as Matt mentioned, we were together in Fresno at the California Southern Baptist Convention, before that the Pastors Conference. Matt was there, my youngest son Andrew was there, and my son-in-law Brian, all pastors, so it was kind of like a family reunion for us. Andrew was the president of the Pastors Conference, which is 2 days leading up to the convention where you have worship and speakers and so forth, and so he was the responsible for recruiting who was going to preach. And he asked me to be one of the speakers early last year, and I told him I didn't think it was appropriate with him being the president of it that he would ask his dad to preach. And he kept pushing me all year, so finally I agreed. And there was most of the speakers were very, very young. And when Andrew introduced me, he said, the reason I asked my dad to preach is I needed at least one old man on the platform. And so I don't know what happened. First time I preached it that years ago, I was the youngest one on the program. Now I'm the oldest one on the program. But the older I get, the more focused I am on the passage that we're looking at today. These are the last recorded words of the Apostle Paul. And we really find in them how you and I can finish well. If we're really essentially spiritually in a relay race, we who now hold the baton of the gospel will someday pass it off. We will hand it off to the next generation. We can't really effectively do that unless we are finishing well ourselves. We all know as Christians, we know this intuitively, and we know it from the experience of others, that in 5 unguarded minutes, we could ruin our Christian testimony. We could have a legacy of failure and shame rather than a legacy of someone who finished well. Years ago, I was preaching at a leadership conference in Glorieta, New Mexico. I don't know if any of you have ever been there. It's a camp that Southern Baptists owned for many, many years, and people would travel there in the summer. And so this was a leadership conference with hundreds and hundreds, maybe several thousand, I guess, of pastors and leaders from across the convention. I was one of the speakers. The other primary speaker was a man named John Bisogno. John Bisogno became a great friend of mine. He went to be with the Lord this last year. He was the pastor for many, many years at First Baptist Church in Houston. And one night during this conference, he gave an illustration that for me became a very haunting illustration. He talked about when he was a young man, he was attended Oklahoma Baptist University, which that's where I went to college as well. And he met a girl that later became his wife. And his father-in-law said to him, said, Johnny, you're going to have to guard your heart in the ministry because there's not one out of 20 of young men like you that will make it to the end. And by make it to the end, he meant that their life won't be somehow spiritually shipwrecked by immorality or some kind of sin within their life, maybe discouragement, disillusionment, bitterness will push them out of the ministry. And Bisogno said that he didn't really believe that. So that day, he wrote in the flyleaf of his Bible 24 names of young men that their ambition was to serve God vocationally. They were soul winners. They were passionate about their relationship with Christ. And he said that night, and he was a man in his early 60s at this time. This was 15 years ago or so. He said, one by one, in my Bible, I've scratched off their names because of failure. And he said, tonight, there are only 3 names left in the flyleaf of my Bible. Now, that was shocking to me, and it made a great impact upon me about thinking about finishing well. I don't know why it should be shocking to us, because beginners are a dime a dozen. Terminators are rare. We're really good at starting things. but we're not so great at finishing things. Now, if you don't believe that, just look in your garage when you go home at all the projects that we start, but sometimes we never get around to finishing. Our culture puts a premium on starting, but not so much on finishing. The saddest illustration of that in our culture is marriage, of starting but not always finishing well. There's a jewelry store in Hollywood that has a big sign. I don't know if maybe they're doing it in jest or not, but it says in big letters, "We rent wedding rings." Now think about that for a moment. That is our culture. In Baptist life, the emphasis is nearly always on the initial step of Christianity. We speak in terms of how many people accepted Christ, how many people were baptized. We present the gospel of a good start, but not all who start well finish well. Now, the context of 2 Timothy is this. The Apostle Paul is in prison in Rome. It is actually the second time he's been in prison. The first time he was under house arrest. People could come and go. He could teach. He could disciple people. But this time, he's not under house arrest. He's in a dungeon. It was nicknamed the Sepulcher. If you've ever been to Rome, you may have visited the Mamertine prison. Really, it's just a pit with a hole that they would let prisoners down in. And he was under the sentence of death, waiting his execution. And so he writes Timothy, who is a much younger man. He's a man that is passionate about the gospel and going into ministry. And Paul is essentially writing him, don't give up in the ministry. Don't give up in your Christian life. Paul knows that he'll soon be gone, and so he pulls out all the steps. He gives one metaphor after another about finishing well. He said, you're a steward, and so guard the gospel like a treasure. You're a soldier, he says, so fight the battle. You're an athlete, so strive for victory. You're a student, give yourself to a lifetime of study. You're a servant, so serve the master. But Paul not only motivates him with his words, but with his life. He becomes retrospective. He looked back over the years of his life, but then he becomes prospective. He looks ahead and he said, there's a crown of righteousness that is waiting for me. Now, by the world's standards, the Apostle Paul's life was a dismal failure. As a young man, he had thrown away the prospects of a bright future. He had jettisoned the prestige of being a renowned rabbi. By his own testimony, he had often been beaten. He had labored on occasion to the point of exhaustion. He was hunted, despised, derided, ridiculed, laughed at, and now he is in prison, waiting execution. Look with me in verse number 6, 2 Timothy 4. He says, for I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. He gives us two images, that of pouring out and that of packing up. I think he's referring to the libation offering. In the Old Testament, as they gave the animal sacrifice, sometimes they would take wine and pour it alongside their sacrifice or even on the fire. Maybe when he says, I'm already being poured out, he's thinking of the violent nature of his own impending death. He's to be beheaded. They would take a prisoner as they struggled, and they would tie them down. They would take a two-bladed axe, and they would sever their head. Their body would become limp, but it would tremble and spray out blood. And maybe that's what Paul is referring to. Maybe he's literally referring to the libation offering. He's saying, my whole life, it's as if it's been a living sacrifice, but now the time of my departure is at hand. The word time could be easily translated season. In the spring of Paul's life, he met the Lord on the road to Damascus, and we know that story. He never got over it. In fact, all through the book of Acts and through his epistles he wrote, time and time again, he would remind us, I was on the road to Damascus, and I met Jesus, and he changed my life. That was in the spring of life. And then he had this long summer run of ministry. And in the fall of life, he was arrested and shuffled from court to court. But now it's the winter of life. And he's facing the end. He says, the time of my departure is at hand. Anyone that ever studies the language of the New Testament of Greek, this is the very first Greek verb you learn, luo. It means to loose. The time of my Loosing is at hand. It's a word that describes an army that's bivouacked, that pulls up the stakes of the tent when they're ready to move. It's a word that describes a ship, that you unfasten the moorings of the ship so it's no longer tethered to the dock. And he says, I'm already being loosed. I'm already being ready to pack it up. These are the valedictory words of Paul. This is the benediction of a life that is well lived. But now as he reminisces about his life, we see why Paul was able to finish well. The reality is the spiritual landscape is littered with broken lives. Pastors who have failed morally, ruined their ministry, but it's not just pastors. It's lay people that had great talent and great passion for the Lord that has either ran away from God, or maybe they didn't run away, maybe they just drifted away. There's a personal word in this for how we can finish well. Look with me in verse number 7. He says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Here's the first principle. In order to finish well, we need to fight for the faith. Now, don't read this as being braggadocious. He's not saying, I have fought the fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. In fact, the personal pronoun in the original language isn't even there. It's simply understood. He's not emphasizing himself. He's describing the nature of the Christian life and the nature of Christian ministry. When we look at the Apostle Paul's life, we see spiritual maturity. We're nearly envious of this man that has weathered so many storms in his life. He, at this point, is like spiritual leather. There's a toughness about his life. And we want that. We want that kind of spiritual maturity. We want the kind of maturity that Paul had where he can say, I have joy unspeakable. He said, I have peace that passeth understanding. He said, I'm content in whatever state I'm in. We want that ministry as pastors that's expansive and pervasive. We want his maturity. We want his ministry. We want the product of his life. But this passage is not about the product of his life. It's about the process. The process of sanctification. The process of becoming more like Christ. And he said the nature of the Christian life, it is a fight. It's not an invitation to health and wealth. It's not a life of ease that's free from struggle or pain. It is a fight. It is our word. It is the word agon. We get our word agony from it. It's an athletic word. It means you have to be tough to finish. There's the constant battle with Satan throughout our life. But then there's a battle of our own old nature that we have. What Paul called on occasion the flesh. In Romans chapter 7, verse number 9, he says, for the good that I will to do, I do not do, but the evil that I will not to do, that I practice. We face that all of our life as believers. We're constantly fighting the flesh. And then there's the battle against culture. I mean, the Apostle Paul's entire life, he was out of step with the culture. There was a constant tension between Paul and the values of the world. The reality is this, as a Christian, there is no end to the line of people that will try to talk you out of doing what you know you should do as a Christian. They will try to influence you for wrong. But Paul says, I've finished, I've fought the fight, and then the second illustration, I've finished the race. The Apostle Paul is now like a marathon runner that runs through the streets, and now he's entering the stadium, and every muscle is straining, his legs are burning, but he refuses to quit. The most enduring image, I think, of years ago, the Barcelona Olympics, was Derek Redmond, the British sprinter. He was in a race, and it wasn't even the finals. It wasn't for the medals. It was an earlier race. And he's running in this sprint, and the camera's focusing on all the runners, and he pulls a hamstring. And the camera zooms in on him as the race finishes. And he's grimacing with pain, but he's limping towards the finish line. His dad crawled over the railing of the stadium and went out on the track. The security guards tried to stop him. He waved them off, and he put his arm around his young son and said, you don't have to do this. But he limped to the finish line because he said he didn't come to start the race. He came to finish the race. And of all those who won that year in the Barcelona Olympics, that is probably the most indelible image upon people's minds is Derek Redmond. Sometimes that's what the Christian life is about. Sometimes it's like Isaiah said, we soar like eagles, or we run and we're not weary. But other times it's about walking and not fainting. Ministry is not about how fast we run. When you're a pastor, it's not about the size of crowd that we preach to. It's about not giving up. It's about enduring to the end as a believer. Paul said, I'm not giving up. He says, I fought the fight. I've ran the race. Those are simply illustrations. Then he gets to the point. He says, I have kept the faith. It means to guard something as a sacred deposit. Life had been full of voices urging him to give up the faith. There were the bribes and the threats of the old nature and the constant whispers of the world. And he says, I've kept the faith. It's not subjective there. It's not personal faith. He's talking about the faith. The faith, the gospel that has been handed to him like a treasure, the objective gospel, the good news. And he says, I've carefully guarded it. I mean, if Paul had not kept the faith, there might not be any faith for anyone to keep today. That's why the Apostle Paul wrote the church at Colossae. They had demoted Jesus to just one of the angels. And Paul wrote and said, no, he is the unique Son of God. That's why he wrote all the churches in the province of Galatia. They had begun in faith, but they said, now we're being completed by good works. And he said, no, it is by faith alone that we are saved. That's why he wrote the church at Corinth. Some denied the resurrection of the Lord. And he said, no, the resurrection is essential. In fact, if Jesus is not raised, there's no forgiveness of sin. That's why I wrote the church at Thessalonica. They were teaching that some believe that Jesus are returned. And he said, no, he is not returned, but he will with the shout of an archangel and with the trumpet of God. If Paul had not kept the faith, there might not be any faith for us to keep today. We're only one generation away from the faith being extinct. That's why we're to guard it like a treasure. If we're in this long relay race, and we are, throughout church history, the baton of the gospel has been handed to us, and we hold it for such a short period of time in our hands, and we have to be careful to hand it off intact to the next generation without compromise, undiluted. That's why we must be willing to resist postmodernism that says truth is created rather than revealed. We have to resist pluralism that says that one way to God is as good as the next, when Jesus said, I am the way. No one comes to the Father but by me. The nature of the Christian life, it is a fight. It is a race. It is an agony. Alexander McLaren, the great British preacher, said the Christian life is not a garden of ease, nor is it a desert devoid of joy, but it is a gymnasium, a place of struggle. We like the product of Paul's life, but we're not so good, positive about the process. About 70 miles or so from where I live are some of the giant sequoia trees. Anyone outside of California that has not seen them can't even comprehend how massive they are. They take a couple thousand years to reach that size. Now, if God wants to grow a pansy, he can do it in a few days. But if he grows a giant, it's over a long period of time. Sometimes we're content to be more like pansy Christians, and we're not welcoming of the process that God wants to bring into our life. Verse 8, he said, finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Here's the principle. In order to finish well, we need to focus on the future. The crown here is not the crown that a king or a queen would wear. It is a laurel wreath that he's describing here, the most prized possession in the athletic world. It's as if someone runs through the streets for mile after mile, and now they enter the Colosseum, and they see the crown. They see it at the end of the race. And Paul is like that runner whose legs are aching, his side is splitting, his lungs are burning, but he says, I will not quit because I can see the crown. Sometimes we get discouraged because we don't see the big picture of what God's doing with our life. Our ultimate reward is not from people, but from the Lord. And our ultimate reward is not now, it's in the future. Like an old timer said, sometimes we have to go where the band doesn't play. There's not always accolades or applause for what we're doing in serving the Lord. But the reward is not at mile one. It's not even at mile five. It's not even at mile 10 or 15 or mile 20. It's at the end of the race. And the Apostle Paul is saying to Timothy, listen, young man, I am so close to the end that I can now see the crown that is waiting for me. Timothy, don't you get bogged down in the hassle of the race or the pettiness of false teachers who major on minors. It's not about now. It is about a crown that is waiting for you. Verse 9. Be diligent to come to me quickly, for Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed for Thessalonica, Cretans for Galatia, Titus for Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Here's the principle. In order to finish well, we need the fellowship of friends. He says, come quickly. Literally, it has come with a velocity. It's a picture of an old man that is in prison, and he's lonely, and he desires fellowship. The reality is this for you and I as believers. We are not likely to finish well alone. The Apostle Paul always had this entourage around him of Timothy's, of Luke's, of Titus, people that he was investing in. In return, there was mutual accountability for him. God has designed us to serve in concert, in coordination with others, in a gathering. We need one another. We're too weak to go alone. And yet sometimes we get the idea that we want to be like the spiritual Lone Ranger. But even the Lone Ranger had Tonto. I mean, God's designed us to live out our faith in a gathering called the church. Sometimes people will say to me, well, Pastor, I can be just as good a Christian without the church. That is so arrogant. Now, you can be a Christian without the church, but it's arrogant to think that you can be just as good, that you can have the same result as doing things different than what God has instructed us to do. I've watched enough of the Discovery Channel to know that it's the lone wildebeest that gets eaten by the lion. It's the zebra that's out there by themselves. That's the one that the lion attacks. We need one another. And sometimes we get discouraged. And sometimes we get hurt, even by people within the church. And we withdraw. Because the fact is, the church, not just this church, but every church, is filled with people with imperfections. I mean, not everyone can be perfect like us, right? I mean, the church has people of imperfections, not to mention those that intentionally, their lifestyles betray their confession. A friend of mine, Jerry Vines, used to quote this little poem, oh, to be on high with saints above, that's glory. But to be here below with saints I know, that's another story. All of us need encouragement. All of us need the accountability of friends. All of us need people that we've given permission to them to snoop around in our life and hold us accountable. People that we let down our guard. We will not finish well alone. Paul had Luke, Timothy, Titus, others. In spite of our differences and irritations, regardless of the hurts, we will not finish well alone. Verse 11. He said, only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for it's useful to me for the ministry. Here's the last principle. In order to finish well, we need to forget the failures of others. He says to Luke, or he says to Timothy, when you come, get Mark and bring him with you. Now, you remember the story of Mark when he was a young man? He went by John Mark sometimes. Paul and Barnabas were in Antioch, and they felt called of God to go on a mission trip. And they left Antioch to Mesopotamia with the call of God in their hearts and the gospel in their lips. And they took a young man with them by the name of John Mark. Somewhere in that trip, there was awful persecution. We know several places it occurred. Somewhere along the way, John Mark quit. And he went back home. We don't know why, but he quit. Later on, when they got ready to go on a second missionary trip, Barnabas says to Paul, let's take John Mark with us. And Paul said, no way. His attitude was, I'm not taking that quitter with me. And there was a conflict that the Bible records between Paul and Barnabas, and it broke up the dynamic duo. And so Barnabas took Mark with him, and Paul took Silas on a missionary trip. But now, Paul says to Timothy, bring Mark with you. He's useful to me for the ministry. Somewhere in the expanse of years, Mark's failure was forgiven. There's some people that they live life with no slight ever escaping them. No injuries ever forgotten or forgiven. They have a list, and it's a long list. It's a growing list of everyone who has mistreated them. They keep that list tucked away in their heart. You want an agenda for misery, then you try to settle every score in life. It creates bitterness. Bitterness comes from wounds that are not healed through forgiveness. It produces a critical, a caustic spirit, even a cynical spirit. It poisons your prayer life. It ruins your home life. It wrecks any ministry. It destroys the joy of your life. If the nature of the Christian life is a fight, you're going to get hurt. If the nature of the Christian life is a race, you're going to get bumped. I remember sitting in my living room years ago watching the L.A. Olympics that time. And Mary Decker held the world record in the 800 meter. And everyone said, she's locked to win the gold. We don't know who else from America is going to win the gold, but Mary Decker is going to win. She's way above the field. And so I watched the final race with Mary Decker, thinking that we were going to win gold. And on the first turn, as they made the first turn on the track, the girl from South Africa bumped Mary Decker, and she fell. And the camera was already focused on her, so they zoomed in, and she kind of rolled on the track. And then they were focused on her face, and you could see the ambition of winning a gold medal just drained from her face, and she sat on the track and cried. It reminded me of a movie that I'd seen about Eric Liddell, the Presbyterian missionary that went to China and ultimately died in a camp there from a brain aneurysm. But he was in the Olympics back in the 1930s. And Eric Liddell refused to run one of his heats on a Sunday, and so someone else allowed him to run a race that he ended up winning. I think it was the 200 meter. But they made a movie about his life called Chariots of Fire. It was a very popular movie many, many years ago. And in this movie, they show him in Scotland when he is running a race at like a county fair. And he's running, and he gets bumped like Mary Decker. And the camera in the movie shows him just rolling, kind of like she did on the track. And just for a fraction of a second, he sits on the track. But then he gets up. And he starts running. He ran in a really unorthodox way with his arms just flailing and his head straight up. I don't even know how he could run like that. But he runs and he catches the pack, and one by one he passes them and wins the race. They both got knocked down. But Eric Liddell did not give up. Sometimes that's what life is about. You can't get in a fight and not get hurt. You're not going to get in a race and not get bumped. And that's the nature of the Christian life. The fact is, you're going to get hurt, sometimes even at church. Sometimes the people that you invest the most in, they turn on you. Not everyone's going to love you. But the key is you have to get back up. Our first child, Matthew's big sister, we named her Charity. She had blonde hair and blue eyes. She was in first grade, and it was the night of her open house, and I was preaching a revival meeting across town, so I came home early to explain to her how I couldn't go to her open house that night, and she was already dressed. She was excited about the open house. She'd put on her favorite dress, which was a real red, really frilly kind of a dress, and she patted me on the leg, said, "It's all right, Daddy. I know you're going to be telling people about Jesus tonight." Well, I was preaching in a little church, and I was giving the invitation. People were coming forward, and there was a phone in the foyer that started ringing, kept ringing. Finally, an usher got up and answered the phone, and as I was finishing the invitation, he motioned for me that the telephone call was for me. So I turned the service over to the pastor, and I went back and took the phone call, and it was the superintendent from her school, and he said that Charity had been hit by a car. And I imagined her being gently bumped in a parking lot, and they said, "We're taking her to the hospital." And so I rushed to the hospital. I was actually closer, and so I pulled in right behind the ambulance, and they unloaded Charity on a gurney. And there was a woman in a black dress that was giving her CPR, and she had a little smudge of blood on her cheek. Ginger got out of the ambulance as well. They took us in a little waiting room, and it seemed like forever, and then there was a young Asian doctor that came in to talk to us. And he kind of stammered, and finally he said, "Your daughter is dead." Some news is hurtful. And then there's some news that is devastating. It was a hit-and-run driver. She didn't stop that night. She turned herself in later, a young woman. She wasn't drinking, but she was speeding and driving very carelessly. Charity was holding hands with Matthew at the time she was hit. She was hit and he was not. They were on the side of the road at the school. It happened on a Thursday night. On Saturday morning, early that morning, there was a knock on our door, and I opened the door, and there was a young woman there that just burst into tears and literally collapsed at my feet. And I knew in a moment this must be the woman that had, the driver who had killed Charity. I helped her up. She's sobbing, and she said, "Will you forgive me?" And under my breath, I prayed, "God, give me grace." And I said, "I forgive you." And I did. It was sometime later that I realized that if I had not said that, someone somewhere would scratch my name off of a list. You will not finish well holding on to the hurts of life. People will fail you. There will be hurts in life. You have to let go. With Apostle Paul, there was a final day that came. I don't know if Mark was there or even if Timothy had made it. They pulled him out of this hole in the ground, this dungeon. He probably covered his eyes. He had not seen the light for some time. They put him in shackles. They took him the short distance to the edge of Rome. There was a chopping block there. He said a few words, I'm sure, of farewell to Luke and whoever, whatever believers were there. He was strapped down, as their custom would be. A burly Roman soldier held a double-bladed axe. And perhaps the Apostle Paul thought for just a moment he saw the glint of the sun on the axe blade. And then he realized, no, in the next moment, it was the sheen on Jesus' face when he said, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," because the Apostle Paul had finished well. God help us to do so. Would you bow with me for prayer?